things. You can't just like sit at home, throw some DNA at some cells, and create like the next horrible biological warfare thing.
Glimpse?
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 I can't do it. Glimpse!
Hi everyone, today's episode is with Tyler Ford from AdGene. It's a great overview about plasmids and CRISPR. If you want to engineer a cell to do something that it doesn't normally do, you have to give it instructions. So the way you do this is you put a plasmid, which is circular DNA, into a cell, and this gives the cell instructions to make different proteins that it wouldn't normally express. And by doing this, the field has been able to engineer bacteria and mammalian cells to do all sorts of really exciting, fascinating things. So in this episode, we discuss the basics of cell genetic engineering. And this episode is a great introduction for our second episode, where we'll be talking with Nicole Derringer, who actually uses plasmids and genetic engineering to engineer new receptors on cells. So without further ado, here's the episode.
Hello, my name is Tyler Ford. I'm an outreach scientist at AdGene, the nonprofit plasmid repository, and my role at AdGene is mostly science communication. I help write and edit blog posts for the company. We actually have our own podcast, the AdGene Podcast. We have protocol videos, we have written protocols, ebooks, all sorts of educational resources for people.
That's great. All right, so let's start at the very beginning. Not as a little kid, do you remember what you wanted to be when you were?
Very first thing I wanted to be was a train conductor.
Okay,
which I feel is common to a lot of little boys.
Toy inspired career,
right? Exactly. Weirdly, I remember in like seventh grade, I switched to just wanting to be a doctor of some kind. I really wanted to have my PhD. I think we were reading about Martin Luther King, actually, and the fact that he was a doctor was really exciting to me. So I wanted to have my PhD in something.
Nice. Did you have any nice role models along the way to help guide you into science?
My undergrad advisor. So I worked in Dr. Tom Gilmore's lab at BU for 2 years as a Beckman Scholar. So he kind of treated me like a grad student, even though I was a later undergrad.
Yeah.
So junior and senior year, I basically spent half my time in the lab working on some simple cancer biology stuff. There were some scary times where I did stuff wrong and I felt really bad about it, but he was very good about kind of teaching me what I did wrong and helping me move on from that.
I usually ask one of those questions at the end. Do you remember one of your most spectacular or memorable failures where like you still cringe thinking about it?
I had a pipetman that I dropped on the ground and basically exploded, and it was right in front of him, and I couldn't do anything but kind of giggle because I was like, what just happened? And he was not happy about it. So I remember kind of like slinking back into my bay and kind of cowering in the corner.
Oh my God. So that was your first lab, right?
BU was my first lab. I did a rotation. When I first got to Harvard, I did a rotation in a lab that was doing kind of stem cell biology stuff. It was interesting, but I realized that I did not like working with mice. And so then I worked in Pam Silver's lab at Harvard. They do a lot of different things. It's a synthetic biology lab, but people are doing all sorts of different projects. There are people trying to work with things that essentially make biological memory circuits in cells. Mm-hmm. There are people who are trying to make artificial chromosomes. There are people who are trying to make biofuels and other compounds.
Do you have a definition of synthetic biology?
When I'm talking to non-scientists, I like to say it's trying to get cells to do things that they wouldn't normally do. And so that can cover a lot of different things from, I don't know, like I said, making them make biofuels or making them treat a disease. All sorts of stuff. There's also a side of it where you're trying to build biological devices, right? So that mimic biology, and you learn how that underlying biology works through trying to build it.
And to be clear, it's not like we can get cells to shoot bullets and
make
ice. It's really you're transplanting systems from one type of cell to another and trying to build on that. So it's almost like this.
Yeah.
It really is engineering in that sense, where you're taking modular units and trying to fit them all together.
Right. Yeah, right? Exactly. I think in the blog post that I just wrote, I broke it down into three things. One was trying to understand more about biology by building it. So mimicking the way cells work as best we can. And then also trying to get cells to produce compounds or to create devices out of cells. So maybe you create a bacterium that will attack a cancer cell, or you create a bacterium that will make a biofuel, something like that. And then the third one is making tools that other biologists can use in their research. So For example, it's a new set of enzymes that makes it easier to make a plasmid or something like that.
So you've mentioned plasmid. Maybe define what that is.
Sure, yeah. So a plasmid is just a circular piece of DNA that encodes genes that make it so a cell will carry out a particular function. So if I put a plasmid into a bacterial cell, I might be able to make that cell glow a certain color. It might make a protein from a human cell that we're interested in studying, all sorts of things.
So the plasmid sounds like it's the basic unit of synthetic biology because that's how you give the cells instructions.
Yeah. So I would say in the early days, basic unit of synthetic biology, more and more people try to put DNA directly into the genome of whatever whatever organism they're working with. There are a lot of different reasons for that, but plasmids are definitely a useful way of getting genes into cells quickly.
So how did you end up in AdGene?
Yeah, so before I went to grad school, this was in 2010, I actually did an internship at AdGene. So back then I was a marketing intern, but I was the person kind of going and looking at websites and saying, okay, we should go talk to this person, this person, this person, making a big list and then sending it to the person who does my job now. That was kind of boring, but my boss knew that that was kind of boring to me. And so she gave me the opportunity to also work on developing some of our original educational content. So back then, and even now, there are particular types of plasmids that can be used to create viruses that were really popular. And people were constantly calling in about how those viruses, asking questions about how those viruses worked. And so we worked on creating some educational web pages that people could just go find that information themselves. And after leaving that job, I was there for 3 months before I went to grad school. I kind of maintained my relationship with a lot of people that worked there. And so when I finished up grad school, which was in, 2015, a scientist position opened up at AdGene. And when I got my phone screen, so I had to talk to the AdGene HR person. She actually told me that they would be opening up a position that was much more science communication directed soon. And because I was very open about like what I wanted out of the role, she was like, oh my God, you would be perfect for this.
Yeah.
So she had me apply for that instead. And that's how I ended up.
Were you nervous about that? Because you're sort of giving up, quote unquote, what you had trained in your PhD and for a job that wasn't posted yet. Like, were you a little nervous about that?
No, actually. So again, I actually did stuff in grad school that geared me more towards science communications, and that worked out well for me when I was applying for this position because it was actually much more in line with what I wanted to do than a strictly like scientist position.
Can you explain AdGene's just their role in science?
Our mission is to accelerate research and discovery by helping researchers share plasmids and also information. So again, plasmids, it's people make plasmids so that they can get cells to carry out particular interesting functions. But when you make a plasmid and you publish on it, other people should have access to that plasmid, right? So they should be able to say, hey, can I have your plasmid and use it in my own research?
Yeah.
But it can often be very difficult for an individual lab to figure out how to send that plasmid out to everybody who wants it, right? And it also just takes a lot of time. You have to grow up bacterial stocks, then you have to figure out whatever the regulations are for wherever you're sending it, all that stuff. So instead of sending it out to between labs directly, the person who made the plasmid could just send it to us and say, hey, if you want to use it, just go to AdGene and get it from them. And actually, we are branching out even right now where a lot of people were using plasmids from the repository to create viruses that are useful for research. And we'll make those viruses for them now and send them the viruses directly. And that's really nice because it's all made in kind of a reproducible way as opposed to people doing it in their own labs and maybe doing things slightly differently from each other all the time.
Okay. And what is the origin story of AdGene? Some grad students saw an opportunity from a lab that was making tons of plasmids, or that's my shot in the dark.
The origin story it's very similar. So basically, our founders are Melina Fan, Ken Fan, and Benji Chen. Melina was a grad student at Harvard, and she found it really difficult to get plasmids from people. So Melina found it very frustrating that she couldn't get everything that she needed. And she kind of figured this is like the perfect point for me to make a startup, because this is clearly an unmet need that it really wouldn't be that hard to fulfill. And so, like I said, again, plasmids were kind of the perfect starting point because they're so easy to store and make. And so she was also lucky because she had her current husband, Benji Chen, another one of the founders. He was a computational science grad student at MIT. And so he helped make all of the online storage systems and databases that we have, where we keep all the information about the plasmids. And then Melina's brother, Ken Fan, was the kind of the financial guy. But they had kind of like all of their basic needs fulfilled through the three of them. And they brought on some other people as well. But to just get things started, it was kind of nice that they had that.
Are you guys a nonprofit or?
We're a nonprofit, okay. Yes. So people often get confused by that. We can take in revenue. But as long as it's being used solely to keep the mission or and satisfy the mission, that's okay.
Yeah.
And essentially, when people buy a plasmid from us, so it's $65 for a plasmid, that goes into just maintaining the repository, keeping people working, doing all that stuff. And it's actually kind of, it's a nicer way to fund it than if we were on grants or something like that, because we don't have to worry about kind of the boom and bust of the grant cycle.
Do you think the creation of AdGene has helped push the science forward because of access?
So for every plasmid that's deposited with us, we actually go through and scrape the literature to see people who have cited our AdGene ID number.
Yeah.
And we list the publications that have cited them. So some of our most popular plasmids have like crazy numbers of publications. I want to say hundreds, probably about right. But you can also, so somebody at, I believe it's the, what is it, the Sloan School of Management, the business school at MIT, has actually taken some of that data and done some research on it. So what she's found is that papers that deposit plasmids with AdGene have more citations than papers that do not deposit plasmids with AdGene.
Oh yeah,
and so that's, it's corrected for a lot of different factors.
But that's got to be great for you guys, right?
Yeah, definitely. Totally. I mean, that's exactly what we want to, what we hope to see and hope to continue to see. I mean, you can also see stuff if you look at like the growth in CRISPR. Basically, everybody who makes CRISPR plasmids. So CRISPR is this amazing genome engineering technology. It makes it easy for you to make changes in DNA sequences. Essentially, everybody who makes new plasmids in CRISPR deposits them with us right away. And something as simple as people trying to use the plasmid in their research by asking about it on Twitter. So people will be like, hey, they made this new plasmid. Is it available at AdGene yet? And we can see that like as soon as a paper comes out.
Oh.
And oftentimes we're like, hold on, we're still going through our quality control process, but it will be available shortly. And you can look at CRISPR distribution and like essentially around, when was it, 2014, 2015, when it started getting popular, you get a huge spike. So obviously people are using us for that. And we think that without us, it would not have gone as quickly.
What's the difference between CRISPR and a plasmid?
Yeah, so CRISPR, basically CRISPR is a couple of different things. So CRISPR is a set of tools that you can use in order to make a change in a DNA sequence. So it requires a few different things, but just for simplicity's sake, it requires different components that can be encoded in a plasmid. So the plasmid itself encodes the different components of CRISPR. Those components, if they get into a cell, can then make changes to the DNA in that cell. So the plasmid essentially is a way of delivering CRISPR
and all of its subunits into the cell.
Right.
So you're still using the plasmid to get the whole CRISPR, this exciting technology, into the cell. But the difference is you're using DNA delivery to deliver something that will change the cell's DNA itself. It's sort of like a two-step process.
Exactly, yeah. The plasmid, like you said, it just makes it really easy to deliver all of the components that CRISPR requires at once. And then CRISPR goes in, essentially attacks the DNA of whatever cell you're putting it into. And that facilitates the the process that causes that DNA to change.
Right. CRISPR is shortened for CRISPR-Cas9. It's two systems together.
Cas9 is associated with CRISPR repeats. So, okay, if you go and you actually, you spell out the acronym, it's, let me see if I can remember this, clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats. So basically CRISPR just essentially describes those repeats that are found in bacterial genomes. So it turns out that those repeats are used to specify DNA sequences of viruses. So bacterium says, hey, if I see this repeat, I want to destroy it. Because if I'm getting infected by a virus, I want to kill that virus, right?
So CRISPR is the heading of your blacklist for a bacteria.
Right.
Like blacklist part one, this virus. Later in the genome, blacklist part two, this virus.
Right. So that's why it's clustered regularly spaced short palindromic repeats.
Okay.
And so then you have these other proteins that use that information that's in the genome to say, okay, I've identified this viral sequence. Now I'm going to cut that piece of DNA And that essentially makes it so, one, you might kill the cell that's been infected, so it can't keep producing other viruses, but it also might chop up the virus itself when it infects.
So it's a defense against invaders in bacteria.
Exactly.
And humans and primates and more complex organisms have a systemic immunity, a cellular immunity. This is like molecular immunity.
Right, exactly.
Enzymatic immunity.
Yeah,
using proteins.
People often describe it as like the bacterial immune system.
Right. So the big breakthrough with CRISPR-Cas9 was previously to target the genome mm-hmm. of a cell. We were using protein-DNA interactions to try to figure out specific regions that we wanted to modify.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have the amazing advantage to be able to use DNA, like base pair matching, which is really specific.
Right.
A lot more easy to engineer than trying to design a protein that will recognize ATCG.
There are CRISPR systems that can be used to modify RNA or destroy RNA as opposed to DNA, which can be useful for different reasons. There are newer CRISPR systems coming out that are more accurate for whatever reason. There are CRISPR systems that can be used to control the production of proteins that are encoded in the genome. There are all sorts of ways that you can use CRISPR. So it's interesting to keep on top of what lots of different people are doing. And for us, that requires us to go out and kind of talk to people who are making all these new technologies and get them to deposit them with us. And also provide educational resources for people. So we will create blog posts about what newer and interesting CRISPR systems do and how they can be used and where the plasmids are and how people can get them. We also have a CRISPR 101 ebook that's been downloaded like over 20,000 times. People can go and grab that and find out a lot about the different applications of CRISPR and actually a little bit of the CRISPR history that we've been talking about too.
What are some of the most, popular or exciting plasmids that you guys are selling? Maybe just give us an overview of what people are doing with
plasmids nowadays. I would say probably the most popular things are plasmids that are used to make these viruses. So more than just delivering CRISPR, you can deliver all sorts of stuff to cells using viruses. So essentially the way that these research viruses work is that they'll package some DNA. So if you have a particular plasmid, maybe that plasmid makes a cell glow green. You put that into the virus, and then you use the virus to get that DNA into whatever specific type of cells you're working with. Now, naturally, that virus might replicate inside that cell, destroy the cell, and then go on to infect other cells. The research virus has been made so that it will only infect, and then it can't do anything anymore.
Gotcha. And to be clear, just really crystal clear,
yeah.
The virus itself is not green. It just carries the instructions that the cell will read and become green.
Correct.
Right. Because we're dealing at the DNA level. I just want to specify that.
Yeah. Another good thing to talk about in terms of like things that are really popular from the repository would be fluorescent proteins. You can make cells glow a certain color. So there are a lot of different reasons you might want to do that. Let's say you're doing a study with cancer cells and you want to see how they travel throughout the mouse's body. You mm-hmm. might want to label them with a certain color so you could see where they go. Inside the actual cell, you can also use fluorescent proteins to label individual proteins that are doing things in the cell. So you could see where they go, what other proteins they're interacting with. There are certain types of fluorescent proteins that can basically, they might change color depending on whether or not there's a chemical in the cell. So there's all sorts of biological phenomena that you can kind of measure pretty well using fluorescent proteins. And we have another ebook as well on fluorescent proteins. So you can find the ebook on our blog or on our website, and it talks about all the applications that you can use them for.
So fluorescent proteins, CRISPR, any other?
Yeah, those are probably our big three.
Okay.
There are plenty of other very popular things.
Yeah. Anything you personally find really cool?
Yeah, so some stuff that's recently been getting pretty popular are things called DREDs, which are basically these channel proteins that you can activate using drugs. So you can make cells basically turn on their activity by giving them a particular drug. There are other things that are optogenetic tools. So basically what that means is they make it so you could shine light on a cell and the cell will then carry out some particular function.
Those are both kind of the same, except one uses light and one uses a synthetic molecule like an antibiotic.
Right. Yeah. As an example, you might have a optogenetic protein in a neuron shine light on that neuron, and it will make it so that neuron starts signaling to other neurons. So you can stimulate brain activity using light, which is super cool. And these aren't like crazy new. They've been around for a while, but they've become, say, increasingly popular over the past couple of years.
Okay. That's crazy. Anything else you want to touch on?
We've kind of touched upon the fact that Agene helps make work more reproducible, right? So yeah. Because you're getting verified reagents that people can use in their research. And as we're going forward and we're branching out into other things, we are kind of trying to really push the reproducibility side. And we're basically talking to a lot of different other organizations that do similar reproducibility things. So people who have online code sharing, people who have online protocol sharing, other companies that try to do more reagent sharing stuff. And what we'd like to see people to see is that there are definitely more and more solutions out there for the issue of reproducibility. So we are trying to push like that idea that like people should be looking to find these resources and also helping people find these resources.
That's a great point. I mean, I think, yeah, to ultimately solve this reproducibility crisis, it would be nice to have an ecosystem where you can just plug and play a bunch of things that have been produced, characterized, and validated by different companies such as Agene or...
Yeah,
I guess GitHub is for code and ATCC for the cell lines, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then you can just take elements from that with, you know, you'll have to do some, probably some optimization in your own lab, but the fact that your starting materials are all kind of verified. And
right. Yeah. And like I said, there are companies doing all sorts of things. One that comes to my head quickly is Protocols.io. They have online protocols that you can just look and say, okay, this is exactly what people did, but then you can also make changes to it based on whatever you're doing. So as like what you said, you might have to optimize it for some reason. You can put that right online. Yeah. People can see it. It's very transparent. And obviously you have other things like online lab notebooks, stuff like that, where it makes it much easier for people to see, hey, this is like the actual record of what I did. And I can share preliminary results through things like Figshare. All sorts of good stuff.
Experiment 83, it finally worked.
Right. Yeah. Or like it makes it easier to find, hey, this thing didn't work.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't be doing it.
I'm glad there's people tackling this challenge.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think one of the key things here, I'd like to believe, I could be wrong, but never attribute to evil what you can attribute to incompetence.
Right.
And not that we're dumb, but just sometimes you're doing something that you don't realize you're doing to make your experiment work.
Right.
Which is a big challenge in science.
Yeah, definitely.
It's like, oh, I changed the source of my water and then nothing works anymore.
Right.
And you just didn't realize it was an important factor. So,
right.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to go into the lightning round questions?
Sure.
All right. So... do you have a favorite factoid?
I actually have a favorite factoid about Boston.
Okay.
Which is an interesting
one.
So a lot of people don't realize that the Charles River is a tidal river. And so every day, the lock system is used to pump water in and out. So it maintains the same level.
Oh, I like that. Is there a common misconception you find yourself addressing?
So I think a common misconception that we can just instantly put a piece of DNA into a cell and make it do anything we want. It's way more complicated than that. I think a lot of people in synthetic biology might want you to believe that that's the way it works, but there's just so much more optimization that you have to do in order to get things to function properly. In some ways, from like an engineering perspective, that's kind of annoying, but in some ways that's good because it means you can't just like sit at home, throw some DNA at some cells, and create like the next horrible biological warfare thing, right?
Yeah, plague 2.0 or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the fact that biology is complicated is both annoying but also good in some ways, that you really do have to have expertise in order to get things to work right.
Not to get too philosophical, do you ever think that barrier will go away as we get better at this? And do you think there's a cause for concern downstream?
Sure. I think probably, I don't know. I think it's something that we should be thinking about, and I'm glad that people are thinking about it, but it's not something that people should be like infinitely scared of right now.
What keeps you going?
Publishing blog posts is kind of addicting. So I can very easily go through and look see how many people have viewed a blog post, how many times they've clicked on links in our blog posts, that kind of thing. And for somebody who's kind of like data oriented, that is super awesome, right? So as soon as I've published something, I can look and see.
Refresh.
I can see how well it's doing. I can optimize later blog posts based on things that are doing better now.
What has been your biggest challenge so far?
I'm very much a people person. And I love to go out and I love to talk to people about what Adgene does and what their research is and stuff. And it's been a very easy sell. I've started doing a little bit more collaborations with other organizations and kind of getting used to the fact that there's always going to be a little bit of conflict in that. Can be a little bit difficult for me because I always want to be like the kind of the people pleaser wherever I'm going, but I'm getting better at it. I would say that's been probably my most difficult thing so far.
What's the best advice you've ever received?
You are not in somebody else's head, particularly you're not in your supervisor's head all the time, right? And so even though you might think something you've done wrong or that you've messed up on is like the biggest deal in the world, this person is not thinking about you 100% of the time, and it's okay to make mistakes. And I think that lowers a lot of anxiety and also helps you realize that, like, you're probably overthinking things sometimes.
Almost certainly.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. That's all I have. So, yeah, thanks.
Yep, no problem.
I would like to thank everyone who helped make Glimpse Podcast possible. Music production by Kevin McLeod. Funding provided by the MIT Postdoctoral Association. For episode information, links, and show notes, please check out our website, glimpse.mit.edu. Thanks for listening.